Our next guest on the program is a journalist, historian, author, professor at the University of Maine. We are pleased to be joined by our friend Michael Sokolow. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Rich.
Well, I want to say, as we all do, one more day, but it's but it's not one more day. This thing is going to go on for, well, I ask you, how long before we know who the next president is?
I don't know, and I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, you're reading the same things I am about the possibility of a landslide, at least, right? We know North Carolina, Florida will count tomorrow night, and we know that that if Biden wins those, President Trump's path would be much smaller. But yeah, I think it makes sense to prepare for it to go on.
What's different about this election than what we saw 4 years ago? Is it simply as obvious as the large number of people who have voted already, or are we seeing a groundswell that wasn't there in the 2016 race?
Well, one of the fascinating things about the early voting that I'm not sure about, when you read about these numbers, you know, here in Maine, we're almost at 500,000, you know, 60-something percent of the total number of voters have already voted, which is astounding. But what that means is, and what we don't know, is what will the polls look like tomorrow? You know, what will the Bangor Civic Center look like when I go down to vote? If it's a ghost town, then that's going to be fascinating for a different reason. Mm. But if the average number of people show up to vote on election day, it's going to be a huge electorate. It's going to be tens of millions larger than in 2016.
Are there fewer undecided people going to the polls or among those who've already voted? Are people pretty firmly in one camp or the other at this point?
All the polls suggest that. Like, everything you read at 538 and elsewhere suggests it. But what I find fascinating about that is there seems to be a lot of chatter around trying to find the shy Trump and the shy Biden voters right now who aren't honest with pollsters. And the truth is, what do you think, Rich? Everybody in my circle who experientially I deal with has their mind made up. But I don't know. What do you think? I'm curious.
I don't know that many people who are shy about their preference. But again, I live in a bit of a bubble. But even the people that I'm pretty sure are Trump people, they're not shy about it.
Right. And the other thing I can't quite figure out is, you heard about yesterday's events down in New York, right? The blocking of the Garden State Parkway.
Right.
The blocking of the bridge. These Trump parades, essentially. And those Trump parades are clearly not persuasive. They're entirely get out the vote. You know, people aren't really talking about that. They're saying, well, why would blocking the Garden State Parkway help Donald Trump, you know, with undecided voters? And the more these kind of things happen or have been happening, the more it does give credence that there really aren't persuadable people out there.
Let's talk about the coverage tomorrow night as we settle in. I'm an old political junkie, been watching these things since, I would say Nixon Humphrey, 1968. What will be different about the way things are reported tomorrow night, knowing what we know about the large number of mail-in and absentee ballots?
Well, here's an interesting thing that everybody seems to be forgetting. Did you stay up to 2:39 a.m. in 2016, Rich? Were you one of the people who stayed up until it was decided?
As a matter of fact, yes, I was.
I mean, I think that is extraordinarily late. Why are we all, we're all here saying like, oh, it's going to be crazy, it's going to be this and that. 2016, everybody you knew was up till 3 a.m., which is pretty amazing, 3 or 4 a.m. And so that's one thing about tomorrow night is to prep for the idea that we're going to have a kind of a repeat, even if it is a landslide for that reason. But the other thing that really is the challenge, I think, for the networks is the question of amplification versus misinformation.
Right.
They can deal with, we're still counting ballots, they can deal with the percentages or X, Y, and Z, they can deal with misinformation or accuracy. What they can't deal with is amplifying the President of the United States live on the airways declaring himself the winner. That, to me, is the thing to watch very closely.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I look at a state like Pennsylvania, where from everything I read, it's quite possible that President Trump could have a lead of 10, 12, maybe even 15% late tomorrow night that evaporates over the course of the next several days. Now, you could still win in a close race, but yeah, what do you do if you're a network executive and the president goes on and says, we've won Pennsylvania? If you cover that, you're amplifying something that may not be true. How do you draw that line as a journalist?
You know, it's fascinating because they have published, NBC News has published a website with what their plans are. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have not.
But they have not answered that question. It's an almost impossibility to conceive of, but it's probably going to happen. So I mean, I'll be watching just like you, Rich. I mean, we'll all be watching to see what happens in that way.
And I think it's important, too, not that people don't know this. Certainly our listeners, who we like to think are smarter than most, know this. But it's actually the rare election night when we know something by 12, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. If you go back to Kennedy-Nixon in 1960, it was well into the next morning before we had any idea. And even then, the count was still an unofficial one. Nixon-Humphrey in 68 went very late as well. And obviously, we know what happened in 2000. But even in 2004, as I recall, we were waiting on Ohio and weren't sure if that might be another long recount situation.
Right. And, you know, funny thing, the New Yorker, by the way, says that John Kerry truly believes he was elected president in 2004 and he won Ohio. But that's a different thing. But what you're saying, though, is fascinating to me because it makes me think that think of how reliant we are on the concession phone call.
Right.
Right. Like, you know, the election was not over at 2:39 a.m. in 2016, but Hillary Clinton called Donald Trump. And that precipitated Trump going out on stage. And you know, I got to guess there's zero chance. I mean, think back to 2000 with Bush versus Gore, and there were two or three concession phone calls.
Right.
Like, yeah. I actually think, yeah. I think a concession phone call is an impossibility in this case ever. It would be fascinating if one occurs.
Well, and from what we know of the president, I don't see any scenario where he concedes, and certainly not going to pick up the phone and call Joe Biden. Now, if it were fairly one-sided the other way, yeah, I suspect Joe Biden would do that. But there are also other forces at play that you're going to see the political parties get involved, and no question you're going to see lawyers get involved in this.
Yeah, I don't think Joe Biden would do it, even if it was a landslide for Trump, for a different reason. Well, not a landslide for Trump would be a different thing, but the Gore conceding twice to Bush on the night of 2000 ended up creating kind of a nightmare for Democrats that I believe they've learned from, you know, in a close election. So I think Biden will be very hesitant to concede right up till the end, that, you know. But the other thing that you said, which is interesting, well, the concession question is really an interesting one, yeah.
And you and I were chatting about this online. It's an interesting thing to note in terms of the number of newspapers that have endorsed President Trump this time around as opposed to 4 years ago.
Yeah, Trump has more newspaper endorsements. Nobody really realizes that, and it's a sad commentary on where the newspaper industry is because, frankly, they've been purchased by more right-wing private equity fund owners that really are using them as political tools. Things like the Spokane Spokesman Review, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, you know, these are big daily newspapers in major cities. It's really a sad statement on the crumbling of the newspaper industry. But the numbers, somebody pointed out at Twitter, the numbers are teeny, teeny. I mean, he was endorsed by only two newspapers with over 100,000 circulation in 2016, and he's endorsed by seven in 2020.
We've talked with you about this, too. There's a lot of chatter out there about the impact of Fox News. But as you've pointed out, they certainly may solidify a base, but they're not reaching enough people to change a lot of minds.
Yeah, that's it's the persuasion case. It's all the social media memes, all the studies show that it's really about getting out the vote. It's about enthusiasm. It's about locking down. But people just aren't persuaded the way we all think they are. And that's why, you know, this odd stuff that Trump was saying in the last debate about Bob Alinsky and Hunter Biden's laptops and all that stuff didn't make much sense to any kind of voter in the middle because they're not, you know, addicted to that right-wing media sphere.
How long do we go back, Michael, in the history of broadcast journalism? Certainly television, was it the 1952 race that was really the first one that was covered throughout election night by the major networks?
Yeah, 52 was the first time the coaxial cable existed, so you could actually do kind of nationwide things. But they generally say the 48 conventions and the 48 race, not the way we would think about it today, because it could only be seen on TV from Boston to Philadelphia and some other things. That's generally when they do it. But 52 is when it's sort of nationalized. But the really big one, and it's kind of interesting, is 56. And it's 56 because it was the first time Huntley and Brinkley were put together, and audiences loved them. And they loved them so much that NBC had to change their evening newscast for the advertising purposes to make a lot of money. They replaced, not John Cameron Swayze, I'm forgetting, he was the CBS guy, I'm forgetting the guy who was there in 56. They replaced him and put Huntley Brinkley in, and they led the ratings for the next 15 years.
Well, and it was election coverage that certainly, along with what he had done during World War II, that propelled Walter Cronkite to the upper echelon.
Yeah, he was the anchor of the TV coverage of election nights before he was in the evening news. So actually, that's an interesting parallel with Huntley Brinkley. In both cases, election nights really draw people in. They're suspenseful. You know, they're exciting live television. I mean, that's a lot of people say, oh, we should discuss horse race journalism, right, and all this kind of thing. But it really is a lot like sports on an emotional level.
It is. We're talking with Michael Sokolow here on Downtown. And I love watching how the local channels cover the election night, because I always say, from back in the days when I was sitting in the corner of the newsroom as a sarcastic sports guy, watching young reporters sometimes succeed and sometimes fail on election night, that's where you separate the wheat from the chaff in the world of journalism, is when reporters have to cover those local elections, particularly when some of them are fairly new to the area and may not know much about the history.
Yeah, that's a great, and I mean that the Senate race here in Maine and a lot of the races here really require understanding, especially with what's happened in the last couple polls with Gideon and Collins. You know, you have to understand the deep reservoir of support of Collins is such a Maine thing that resonates in Maine. There's been tons of national coverage of the Maine campaigns. And actually, Rich, I know, have you seen some of this? You know, in Slate and the Washington Post, you've seen these articles about the Collins-Gideon race. I'm curious if you think the national coverage captures us in Maine well?
No, I don't think so, because I think they quite often don't dig deep enough and see the reputation. And the reputation, as we know here in Maine on the ground, of Susan Collins has changed greatly over the course of the last, I would say, 24 months or so. And I know in talking to a lot of friends of mine who have voted for her in the past that aren't very happy with her and definitely won't vote for her again. And I don't know if that's reflected out in the national publications, if they have the understanding of how deep that anger runs.
Yeah, it's been very interesting seeing Maine be kind of the center of the Senate of a really important national case. I can't remember the last time a Maine race was this big and important nationally.
But I also think there's, as we know from here and around the country, sometimes people get in that booth, and as angry as they've been, they think about the many times they voted for that person in the past. And I think it takes quite a leap of faith when someone's been there for a while. We saw it back in 1972 when Margaret Chase Smith had been a legend in not just Maine, but national politics. And it took a lot for people to go in there and vote for Bill Hathaway 48 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and we know, you know, here we are talking the night before an election. It always breaks towards the incumbent, no matter how bad things are. I mean, you think about 76 is an election that's just wild. Nixon had resigned. It was the most corrupt administration in history. And Ford made a run. Ford won more states. He lost the electoral college, but he won more states than Carter. And that's the one that always boggles my mind. Because, you know, who was voting for a Republican 18 months after the Republican president should have gone to jail? It was pardoned by his successor. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I see this right now. I mean, the 538 has Trump's approval is climbing, has climbed quite a bit, almost two full points in a week. because there's something weird about, I don't know what it is. People have said it's the devil you know experience. But there is something strange about how you the incumbent benefits right at the end of towards an election.
I'm also curious to see how well broadcasters and newspapers, anybody here in Maine, is able to explain to the average viewer or reader ranked choice voting, because I think particularly in the Senate race, that may end up being a deciding factor.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. I do not think the national press has done a good enough job of that at all. And I think that's a disservice, because I don't know, isn't it on the ballot in Massachusetts, or it's coming on, it's going to be on the ballot in Massachusetts soon. And they really have to explain it better. They have to make they shouldn't make it sound exotic. They should just say, you know, you got to get 50% to win or something. They have to simplify it for the people out there. But, Rich, I have a question for you about TV coverage and journalism coverage. Because, you know, going back to what we said about if Trump makes his live talk, I'm making you the president of a network, okay? The president of the United States has decided to come on right at half hour after the polls closed and declared he won. What do you do? I'm curious, you know, as a media person, what's your call right there?
Well, I'm torn on that. I think you have to cover it. He is the president. By the very nature of that, he makes news when he speaks. But I think you need to have constitutional scholars there, lawyers, people who can quickly respond and explain that this statement means nothing. It carries no legal weight. And here's the reality. Here's who, because I'm not sure people understand this. I was explaining it to students today. I don't know how many people out there, even those who have voted, understand who decides who wins a state, the role of secretaries of state, the role later of the Electoral College and when they vote. And I think if you're going to give the president that moment to make that statement, then you have to balance that by offering to people the reality of the situation.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It makes me think. It is, but, you know, I think amplifying his voice is really going to be a serious problem. I don't think the truth sandwich that they're talking about, where you say the truth, have the lie in there, and then remind people of the truth, I just don't think it's powerful enough. I think the amplification is really important. And that's, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but that's the big question. My theory, though, which I'm too afraid to tweet, is that ultimately this entire election will be decided by Bill Barr, the attorney general. Because Trump has said the lawsuits got there. An attorney general has never sued a state to stop or certify an electoral vote and keep a president in office. It would be an unprecedented abuse of power. And if people forget, in Gore versus Bush, it was the campaigns that sued Florida. There was no incumbent.
Mm.
So, you know, it seems pretty clear. Trump has said we're sending our lawyers in as soon as the polls close. And when he says our lawyers, if it's Bill Barr, the U.S. Attorney General in the Department of Justice, that is a huge constitutional crisis. If it's his campaign lawyers, no worries. It's meaningless. And that to me is what I'm really looking out for on Tuesday night into Wednesday, if the U.S. Department of Justice intervenes in the election.
And I'm also hopeful that we don't see what I fear in those late night moments when I'm tossing and turning, that we see blatant and perhaps violent efforts at voter suppression tomorrow. And then if the results are muddled, as I expect they will be, I worry about the response to any statements by Trump or people taking to the streets, and that somehow turning violent, because as we know, the president has a tendency to escalate these situations. And I worry, I've been saying for quite some time, I think the next 70 or 80 days are among the most challenging and maybe dangerous that we've lived through perhaps since the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think that a normal malfunction of a voting machine, which, by the way, happens around the United States every election. Voting machines malfunction. They occasionally do. It occurs, creates lines, isn't it? Nobody's going to look at that tomorrow as any kind of normal thing. Everything is going to be amplified tremendously.
And then down the road, this will be the leading story on the nightly newscast, I would assume, from now until January 20th, and it becomes then some sort of strange legal battle. And at what point in that process, Michael, if they haven't already, do people lose faith in the system?
That's a great question. I actually flip it around and say, you know what? I'm happy that so many people are voting. And I would encourage any listener out there who's undecided if they're going to vote tomorrow, please go vote. I think these numbers we're seeing of return ballots, and I hope tomorrow is a huge turnout, I think that is faith in the system. I think that's people, whether they support Trump or whether they support, that's people saying, I want to use the system to make this work. To me, like I said, the real question on the legal stuff is whether it's simply Trump cronies, Trump attorneys like Rudy Giuliani and Michael Cohen and those kind of people suing to keep him off, because nobody's going to take them seriously in the lawsuit, or if it's the U.S. Federal Department of Justice. That, to me, is where the system is on trial, if you will. If Bill Barr does not intervene in the election and Trump is losing from the count after Election Day, he's out. It's not. I don't see the kind of constitutional crisis or people thinking in that way. So that's why I think the Department of Justice is massive.
All right, I'm not even going to think about that, or I won't get any sleep at all. Michael, it is always good to talk with you and get your insight into matters. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Will you watch tomorrow night? Will you be glued to the set? How late will you stay up?
Everybody's going to be up all night tomorrow, Rich.
That's what I'm thinking. All right, well, rest up tonight then if you can, and we'll talk with you down the road. Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Michael Sokolow with us here on Downtown.